soul, nefesh in Hebrew, which is the principle of life of the body, translated here as the animal soul. And animals have it as well. And then it contains basic powers, basic abilities, like imagination, memory, intelligence, and will. Not free will, but will. In addition to this, however, there is in man a detached nefesh, very high. And the purpose of man having this extra soul is to enable man to be connected to elements in the chain that exists from God to the world, all of the spiritual elements, so that man's actions can create consequences in that chain. And also that he can receive directly what we decided to call divine energy. That would be quite the right word, but shefa in Hebrew. From those higher sources. In other words, In the image of the rope ladder that I gave you some time ago, you have a rope ladder, and you have something at the bottom. So there's something at the top. It gives the rope ladder a shake, then the shape communicates itself all the way down to the thing at the bottom, and it can feel the motion. Similarly, if something at the bottom could act on its own, squirrels can't, chimpanzees can't, the human beings can act at the bottom on their own because they're connected to the ladder. Their actions give it a shake from the bottom and could also cause ripples coming up. In addition to that, man's soul, the upper soul, the higher soul, enables them to be connected to higher parts of the ladder directly, not just by shaking at the bottom. In other words, shaking at the bottom means, translation of it is, causing the body to move in a certain way. The body is connected at the bottom. Man, because he has free will, can therefore move his body in a certain way. And that motion, because it's connected to the ladder, can give the ladder a shake from the bottom. But then there would be ways to use his soul directly to connect to the higher elements of the ladder, not by shaking from the bottom, but by sort of reaching up and grabbing it and shaking it from the middle, or shaking it close to the top. A man has both of those abilities, the second of which he will describe in more detail in the next chapter. And then he says, this is what I alluded to yesterday, that the upper soul, which he, what he calls here the divine soul.
Who says that? I'm sorry. Who says that?
What I'm saying now?
Yes.
We are working on a text called the Derech Hashem by Lutzato. So I'm just explaining what he says. This is Moshe Chaim Lutzato. Furthermore, he says that this upper soul, which he translates as a divine soul, I'm not quite sure what that means. The Hebrew says the upper soul directs the lower soul and acts on it all of the actions that are necessary in all of man's conditions. And this upper soul is connected to the lower soul, and the lower soul in its most refined elements is connected, and then it comes out that the soul, the upper soul, the lower soul, and the body are all connected to one another. Now this is what I alluded to yesterday. He says that the upper soul is connected to the lower soul and directs the lower soul and acts on it, all the actions that are needed. Does that include everything the lower soul does? The lower soul is responsible for growth. The lower soul is responsible for perception. The lower soul is responsible for all of our animal functions. The functions that we share with animals. If I take this literally and take it universally, then I think you'd have a position like the Rambam's position. That although we have a lower soul that's similar in some way, or does the same function, I should say, as the animal soul of a horse. But in our case, that lower soul is under the control of and the direction of a divine soul. In the horse, there is no divine soul. So it isn't operating alone. It's not just additive. It's not just you have the lower one and the upper one, each does its own job, and, you know, time to go home. But the upper one directs the lower one also. So it would mean that man's growth is initiated by the divine soul. It isn't that the divine soul is just attached to a body that grows on its own. Now, I want to expand on this a little bit. I have an observation to make, which I think is very important. Maimonides says that in Olam Haba, in the world to come, there's no body. The body left behind. The body disintegrates and disappears. The whole of the physical world will disappear. Only the soul goes to Olam Haba. I have told you over and over again that, according to Lozzato and others, that the body does go to Olam Haba. Indeed, even among the medievals, Maimonides' position was, I think, a minority position. And then, since he didn't have the Kabbalah, as far as I know, there's a kind of consensus that has closed against the Rambam. I don't think anybody today would take the position that he took, that the body doesn't go to Olam Haba. For many years, I taught this simply as a dissonance of opinion. And pointed out that since the Rambam didn't have the Kabbalah, the consensus is closed against it. A few years ago, rereading the sources, I noticed something which now leads me to think that the disagreement isn't all that big. Maybe it's very small, and maybe it just comes down to semantics. I'm not 100% sure. About this, I've had discussions with people. We're not agreed on how big to make the difference. But it certainly isn't as big as it sounds. And here's the reason. Let's take the Rambam's position. That it's the upper soul which directs everything that happens in the body. Think what that upper soul must be like. That upper soul has a finger pointing at liver function. It has a finger pointing at the stomach for digestion. It has a finger pointing at the GH, growth hormone, which I'm now told if you do anaerobic exercise, even when you're old, it releases the growth hormone and you stay young, which is what I'm trying to do as I run the treadmill. The soul has a finger directed at the eyeball to see, to close, to turn right and left. As a finger pointed at the biceps, when something needs to be lifted to contract the biceps. The soul has a body face. The soul has a face that faces towards the body and is responsible for all the operations of the body. Okay, now let's imagine, along with the Rambam.
Is the upper soul?
Yeah, for the Rambam, I don't know if he counts it a lower soul. He just has the soul. Now let's imagine, according to the Rambam, that the body is left behind. And the soul goes to Olam Haba. I never saw anywhere in the Rambam that part of the soul was sliced off. The soul, it seems, goes in complete. Part of the soul is, I would call it, a body orientation. It's body conscious. It's body focused. there just doesn't happen to be anybody to focus on. Okay? That can happen. But part of the character of the soul is body function. And that's going to be there. Okay, that's the normal side. Now let's take a look at the Kabbalist side. Lutzato, in the Understanding Heart, describes what happens ultimately to the body. I sort of mentioned this by the by. I didn't make a big deal out of it, but I said that the body isn't the body as we know it. The body isn't, it has to be transformed into something which represents it, but isn't exactly as we know it. After all, as you remember, for Adam, his body wasn't like our body at all. The result of Adam's failure is that this whole, the whole creation dropped a level, and our physical world came into existence. Before that, our physical world didn't exist. It was a whole level more spiritual. As I told you then, what we call spirituality was for Adam his physical level. I mentioned to you more recently that Adam, as he was created, could see from one end of the creation to the other, because his body didn't limit the abilities of his soul the way our body limits the abilities of our soul. Now, Adam's challenge was to act in such a way as to transform his body into something which would be an ally of his spirituality, and then with that he could go into Olam Haba. That was the name of the challenge. Now in the Understanding Heart, he gives a little more detail. And the picture works like this. It's really in five stages. Let's start here. We're alive because the body and soul are connected to one another, related to one another, and interacting with one another. Death is when they part company. Okay, now, we have to eat to stay alive. Here's a puzzle. How does ingesting and digesting hamburger keep the soul attached to the body? What does one thing have to do with the other? I understand how ingesting a hamburger can keep a horse alive. A horse is just a physical body, and it's ingesting physical stuff which gives it physical energy. But here, the life of a human being is the soul being, is the soul interacting with the body. How can the body ingesting hamburger keep the soul attached? What does one thing have to do with the other?
Is it possible that body should have a certain level of energy in order for soul to effectively manage that part of the body?
That's the name of the question. That's not the answer to the question. The name of the question is, why should the energy level of the body have any relationship whatsoever to maintaining an interaction with the soul?
Because it's like the ripple with the thing. You're on the bottom and you go, you ripple.
Okay, so I you could guess and make up all sorts of answers. Let me tell you what the Tata says. He says that there's a principle that when an item is in a foreign context, in a foreign environment, it has to play by the rules of the foreign environment. When in Rome, the soul here plays by the rules of the body because it is interacting with a physical world. That's a general principle. That an item that's out of its place has to play by the rules of the place that it's in. The flip side, he says, is Moses on Mount Sinai. What happened to Moses on Mount Sinai? He was there for 40 days and 40 nights, three times. And each time he didn't eat or drink for 40 days and 40 nights. Let me ask a question. Do you think he lost weight? This is the real crash diet, you know? Boy, you can take off all those extra pounds. God will keep you alive, miraculously, but you're not eating or drinking.
Well, his body energy level was maintained.
There was no weight.
Probably not, right? Probably he didn't lose weight. Didn't come down a skeleton. Right? He didn't go up a sumo wrestler and come down a skeleton. That's probably not what happened. Right? So no, if so, how come? How come he didn't lose weight? He didn't eat or drink anything for 40 days and 40 nights. So the Tato says, the same rule that I told you before now applies in reverse. Here, the body is out of place. The body has entered a spiritual realm. It's out of place. Then the body has to play according to the rules of the environment. And since Moses was being spiritually nourished, the body benefited also from that spiritual nourishment. It's the exact reverse of the situation we have here. In our world, when the body eats hamburger, the soul can stay connected. There, when the soul is being nourished, the body maintains its condition. Now, that's one step up. Okay, let me give you the picture, and I'll be glad to take all the questions. I'll answer the questions now, I'll let her finish the picture. That's one step up. Where the body exists, the body has its demands and needs, but it plays according to the role, the rules of the soul. Above that, there's a stage in which the body no longer has any independent needs of its own at all. It doesn't function as a separate, different element. It functions as a tool in the hands of the soul, whose whole being and whose whole operation is only what the soul can do with it. That's stage three. Stage two, the body has its own needs. Only it can get its needs satisfied by what happens to the soul. In stage three, it doesn't have its own needs. In stage four, and this is more or less what he says, in stage four, the body becomes just an aspect of the soul. It isn't a tool in the hands of the soul, it's an aspect of the soul. It's the embodiment capacity of the soul. The soul has the capacity to be embodied, to be related to a different element, to interact, to play a duality, a double role with another element. The soul has that capacity. Stage four, what you're left with is that capacity. But that capacity isn't realized because the extra separate element and interaction no longer is there. Just it's the capacity of the soul to be like that, to function like that. The fifth level, what you have is the memory of that capacity. You don't have the full capacity either. All you have is a memory of that capacity. Let's say an idea of that capacity. That's all you have left. The body becomes transformed step by step into an aspect of the soul, and that aspect of the soul becomes reduced ultimately to an idea. An idea the soul has for a possibility, but that's all. Now, when I think about the Rambam's picture and the Tzaddik's picture, I don't think they're so far apart. In the Tzaddik's picture, what you end up with is a soul which has in it the capacity to be embodied, or maybe a little less, it has the idea of a capacity to be embodied. In the Rambam's case, you have a soul which has a bodily face, a body face, you know, a body focus, but just, it's a body focus, but there's no body there to focus on. So it's just a body focus. What the difference would be, ultimately, between a soul with a body focus, which is the Rambam's picture, and a soul with an idea of the capacity to be embodied, which is Luzzato's picture, I think the difference has become very thin. Very ethereal. Now, if I'm right, that it, my son, whom I quote it often, and you know I have tremendous respect for him, my son thinks it's a little more than I think it is. But even so, it sounds like the Rambam here is sort of backing into an idea which is very close to the Kabbalistic idea. He's coming at it from an entirely different perspective. He didn't have the Kabbalah. And it will be one of those cases where you see the integration of the tradition that even without a certain piece, if you meditate carefully on the other pieces, they will lead you in the direction of the missing piece. Because it is all one whole. It is all one integrated system. So even without the other piece, even without the Kabbalistic sources, if you meditate on the other parts carefully enough, what my son says is that still, in the Luzzato picture, the body doesn't disappear. It's transformed into something. And therefore, the Luzzato picture, it's more there than it is in the Rambam. In the Rambam's case, it just disappears. It disappears, disintegrates, and is annihilated, and the whole section of the creation disappears. That's a much more dramatic picture than Luzzato's picture of gradual transformation. Okay, I'm inclined to look more at the final result, he's more inclined to look at the process that leads to the final result and use that as a symptom of the fact that the final result is more different than I think. But still, the difference is not as dramatic as I used to think. One has a body, one doesn't have a body. When you look at what of the body is left, and you look at what the Rambam builds into the soul, the difference, I think, becomes much less. Yeah.
Why is the Latsato's process necessary? Like, why is it necessary for it to have that connection? Like, I can understand the Rambam, it's more of like a complete theory. Like, this is your soul, and it controls the body. Like, the Latsato has his upper soul and the lower soul. Like, why is it necessary to have that separation? Why is it necessary to even have that transformation at all?
Well, I'm not sure what you're asking. Are you asking about the picture of what's going on here, or are you talking about the picture of the transformation, which ends up the way I described it in Olam HaBa? Which are you asking about that?
I like kind of both.
Oh, okay. Well, the reason for Olam HaBa is this. The body, by its very nature, together with the whole of the physical world, by its very nature, hides God's presence. That's what it does. That's why we said in part one that the material world is evil. What's evil about it? What is the inherent evil in the material world? It is that it is designed to be able to hide God's presence. The extent to which God's presence is hidden is the extent to which we find it difficult to connect, difficult to be attached, vacuous, with God. And since the highest perfection is that kind of connection, so the physical world inhibits that. Now, in Olam HaBa, there's no evil at all. So there can't be anything inhibiting the attachment to God. No. Well, if there can't be anything inhibiting it, and the body by its very nature inhibits it, so the body has to be somehow neutralized to a position where it doesn't inhibit it anymore. Now, it seems that if you don't go the full five steps, according to the Sadhu, then what you will have left over is some possibility of distracting the person's connection to God. That's the general picture of what's going on. Yeah.
Correct me if I'm wrong, Rabbi Zazel says that the soul originally couldn't be contained because he used the example but the soul is so strong in the original state that it can't be contained by a body. The body would just cease to exist if you try to put it in there. So if that's the original state and you're trying to get to the original state, so ultimately what should happen is that the body should cease to exist once you reach that perfection.
Yeah, what you're saying now occurs several times in different contexts. Let me explain what it is in one context. If I'm missing, I'm not getting your idea exactly, you'll say it again. At one point he says this, in our condition, after Eden, if the soul would be connected to the body with the same strength that Adam's soul had, the body would be obliterated. It's sort of like pumping 220 electricity into a 110 appliance, you know. It just fries. Now, that doesn't mean that the soul and the body don't connect. That doesn't mean that it doesn't have an effect. It means that you, first of all, get a transformer and step down the electricity so that the body can take it. And then it transforms the body step by step. The body doesn't have a voltage. So it's not either obliterate or disconnect. No, it means connect with lower voltage. And then, little by little, it transforms the body to the point where the body can then be absorbed by the totality of the soul. So the fact that it'll blow it up is not permanent. It's only a temporary thing until the body can be raised step by step.
Does it mean that Rambam doesn't believe in the resurrection of the dead?
He believes in the resurrection of the dead for a period of judgment, and then, again, the body disappears. It's quite unbelievable. Yeah.
What's the logic in the fact that because the transformation takes a few steps, therefore the end result is going to be different?
I mean, why shouldn't it happen in one stage?
No, you said that your son said that the fact that there's this transformation means the end result is different. What's the logic in that? Is the logic there that maybe the Rambam therefore doesn't mean that because it doesn't take it that way? Or is it in the fact that the transformation is taking a few steps that there's a distinction?
I know, it's not the number of steps. It's the nature of the process. The Rambam, the body's just left behind. You just cut it off and let the soul go straight. for the Sato, the body goes through a process of being, so to speak, reabsorbed into the soul. So it's there. It's there in a very transformed state. For the Rambam, it isn't there at all. Now I say, okay, you say the words, it is there. But when you look at the description of what's left, there's very little left. He says, okay, I understand the description of what's left, but what's left is what's left from the body that's still there. And in the Rambam's case, the body isn't there. And he says to me, I'm sort of not taking that seriously enough.
The fact that I'm called is still there.
That's right. Yeah.
The body is not wholly a physical thing. It has a lot of very spiritual aspects to it.
This is extremely important. This is extremely important. Think now of the words here. He says the body is not wholly a physical thing. It has to have spiritual aspects to it. That's true. But even the thing that's, if you think of what you're denying, you could see that what you're denying is impossible at the outset. You don't need this discussion to say it that way. What's the alternative? That the body really is a physical thing, not spiritual. Okay. Who would be its creator? God? Who's all spirit? How could it be totally not spiritual? The universe has to be one-dimensional eventually. The universe has to be, well, it can't be two-dimensional. Two-dimensional means two gods. Everything comes from the same root. Everything comes from the same source. There can't be a great divide in the creation and things coming, having a totally different, essentially different
character. A rock also then would have a spiritual character.
Of course, and that's why Lutzato says that the whole of the universe remains. Even the rocks get a totem of us. Nothing is lost. The whole world reaches its perfection as well, not just the human body. For that very same reason, because everything has the same creator. So, of course, there are different levels, there are different manifestations, there are different clothes that the thing wears, but ultimately it's all fed by the same will, the will of God. That's extremely important, but as I say, it doesn't have to come only from here. It's a fundamental principle in general. Yeah.
Now, I don't really understand. We said that according to the Ramchal, he says that he changes the body, he keeps changing. But the Ramchal also admits that when a person dies, he leaves behind the physical aspect of his body. Now, why couldn't, I mean, and then the spiritual aspect of the body goes through changes.
I mean, no! You're leaving out. What he pointed out, what about resurrection?
So then he reattains his physical...
That's right, and that's what goes together with him. That resurrection...
You can't have the physical in the Olam Haba.
Let's get the stages on the table, right? The person dies in this world, the body disintegrates, the soul goes to into a holding pattern, you know, circling above the airport. So the soul world waiting for resurrection. Resurrection means a reconnection to a physical body. Okay, what kind of physical body? Perhaps a physical body on the level of Adam's original body. But it's a body, right? Just like he had a body. Right? Then that body goes with into Olam Haba, only it is transformed step by step into something else.
So physical gets changed.
Whatever the word physical now means, right?
But it has to be. It has to be spiritual.
That's my answer to him. The physical also is spiritual.
Okay, I'm just saying that.
So then, what's
but the thing? But the physical aspect is what gets left behind.
I don't know what that means.
We're saying that whatever body, quote unquote, a person is going to get during the resurrection of the dead.
Right.
It has to be a body that is wholly spiritual, because any physical part of it will not be able to exist in Olam Haba.
Okay, you're leaving out steps in the process. Again, you have resurrection,
right,
at which time a person is provided with a body, and then that body is successively refined in the five steps that I mentioned, and the four steps that I mentioned, to qualify for the ultimate position of Olam Haba. Doesn't happen immediately.
Oh, so you're saying that his, even the body he gets later is very... partially physical, and the physical is slowly reached out to become all spiritual.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
Why
does
the body have to be... why does soul have to be resurrected with the body?
Why does it have to be connected with the body?
Yeah.
For free will. I've been
after a person dies.
Oh, why is it important that it be... Okay. I was waiting for somebody to ask this. The Gemara gives the following analogy. A man had an orchard, and he noticed that the fruit was being stolen. And his attention focused on two people, and he accused them of being thieves. And they said, "You're making a mistake. Look again. One of us is crippled. He can't walk. He certainly didn't steal your fruit. And the other of us is blind. He can't see where to go. So he didn't steal your fruit." So the owner of the orchard said, "You can't fool me. I know how you did it." The blind one picked up the cripple on his shoulders, and the cripple, who could see, told him where to walk to steal the fruit. Says the Gemara, if God will come to the soul and say, "Why did you rebel against me? Why did you transgress?" The soul will say, "I? You know that I love only the good, the right, the pure, the beautiful, the holy. Surely I didn't transgress." And God will come to the body and say, "Why did you transgress?" The body will say, "I have no executive powers. I can't make any choices. What do you mean? I'm just an animal. You know, you can't blame me for what happened." The God says, "I know how you did it. It was the two of you together." Therefore, says the Gemara, the judgment, the ultimate judgment, has to be for the soul and body together. Otherwise, it isn't just. Because the judgment has to apply to the agent that performed the action. And the agent that performed the action is soul and body together. Thus far the Gemara. The Gemara wants to explain why resurrection is necessary for the final judgment. But now, the corollary is obvious. If you have to reconstitute the agent in order for the judgment to be just, what are you going to do with reward? Whom shall you reward? You have to reward the agent that performed the action. And since the agent was soul plus body, so soul plus body has to be there for the reward. Chazal have the beautiful expression, "Ein kodesh baruch hu mekapeh schar kol birya." God does not withhold reward from any creature. Now, intuitively you don't think of it this way, but that's what the words say. What about the body of the person? Didn't the body of the person participate in all the good things that he did? Yes. So how can you withhold reward from him? That's a moral deduction of resurrection and the existence of the body in the world to come.
This is why some convictions have their body preserved so much better.
Okay, yeah, maybe, but that's stepping pretty far afield. Yeah. Yes, in the back.
He's discussing this. He says that very few people are resurrected. Is this true?
It depends upon how you count. It depends on what you mean. According to Lusato, anyway, the number of people who are lost is vanishingly small. Vanishingly small. He says over and over again that it's, in some places, Lusato says, no one is lost. In other places, he said, like the Zohar Hashem, he says, it's a vanishingly small number. You have to work very, very hard, dedicatedly, purposely, to annihilate yourself. It doesn't happen otherwise. Yeah.
This concept of resurrection takes place on an individual level, along a continuum of time, or if it happens to everybody, what about the man Mashiach? How does that?
Oh, so this is very interesting. There is a big discussion in the Rishonim. I don't remember if the Tzadik really commits himself to this. Some say that the time of the Messiah can go on for a long period, and the resurrection can be throughout the period. Some people earlier, and some people later. Others say it happens only at the end. And this was a great realized a couple of years ago, I went through some of the sources. It's a great help for the Rambam. And the Rambam will hold, I don't think he says it explicitly, but he'll hold with those who say that it's a long process. He says that the Messianic era could go on for a long time. When will be the resurrection? If it's a long process, then you can get a solution to a problem in the Rambam, which otherwise I don't know how to solve. The Rambam says that a person must achieve knowledge of God. Knowledge of God, understanding of God. Because that knowledge is the medium for his ability to relate to God in Olam Habo. Without that knowledge, you just can't connect. Well, as everyone knows, there are people who don't achieve it, and they don't achieve it through no fault of their own. They're good, dedicated, reliable people, focused people, but they live in war times, or they're so poor that they'll starve if they don't spend all the time working, or they have diseases. And these people never achieve it. Now, what are we going to say about this person who, from every point of view, is a tzaddik? He's a righteous, holy person, but never achieved the knowledge of God because he never had the opportunity. So I suppose if you're really desperate, you could say it must be that he isn't righteous, otherwise God would have given him the opportunity. Now we, who hold with the Kabbalistic tradition, have an easy way out. The easy way out is, whose time? About a week.
Gilgul.
Reincarnation. If he didn't make it this time, he'll come back another time, and he will be given the opportunity. The Rambam doesn't have reincarnation. So I was always stunned. So what happens to this poor person? But if you say that resurrection, and then there's one other thing to put into the soup. Many say that at the times of the Messiah, the knowledge of God will be so open, so universal, so obvious, that there will be little or no free will. Ramban, Nachmanides, says explicitly there will be no free will. There's no will. Because the reality is so open and clear, you know, to eat a cheeseburger would be like jumping into the fire. Normal people don't jump at the fire. If so, if the time of the Messiah is a time when there is no free will, what's it for? What good does it do? What function does it serve? Now, those two things fall together beautifully with respect to the Rambam. It's a time when the people who didn't have knowledge of God because of no fault of their own. They were wonderful people, tzaddikim, but because of circumstances, couldn't achieve it. It's a time when they can be resurrected early and, without any free will, can go through the paces of acquiring that knowledge. In other words, the knowledge will be given to them as a gift in the period of resurrection. The only thing you have to assume is that the knowledge has to come here. I don't exactly know why that is, but the knowledge has to come here before you go there. But that way, you enable them to get in. So the things dovetail beautifully. If that's,
so what about the other people?
Other people can be resurrected at the end. It's a long period. Some are resurrected early, some are resurrected later. The ones who are resurrected in the beginning are the people who yet need to go through that process of acquiring the knowledge, and who through no fault of their own didn't get it. Others who did get it can be resurrected at the end. They don't need that. And it's just, I saw that like a wanted to fall off my chair. Yeah. Ooh, what did they,
How does Nachmanides explain the span of time in the Messiah? What's it for?
That's a good question. I don't know, maybe Gilgal doesn't work for everybody. You know, it doesn't help for everybody. I don't know. That's the question. I didn't have it. It worked out nicely for him. Unless he will say, oh, he doesn't have to say that. He doesn't commit himself on that. He could say the resurrection is only at the end.
No.
You said before about the soul, the higher soul, pointing at your different functions. You know, and isn't that will though? What you do, the way your body works, it's from your, you know, your will gives your brain the power to tell your things to work.
Right.
So in that soul, that higher soul is your will?
No, it has many more functions than your will. Let me give you an analogy. This is history of science. Today we know this is all nonsense, but in the 1930s in America, they had a crazy theory. The theory was thinking is talking. All thinking is talking. When you're thinking, you're talking. Don't be stupid. You know, I think silently. I don't have to talk. Yeah, they said, but that's true. But you have to know, it's your larynx. Your larynx is bobbing up and down. You're just not pushing any air through. But the larynx is bobbing up and down just as if you were talking. Uh-huh. That's the theory. Good. And what happens if a person has a laryngotomy? They cut out his larynx? Then he can't think? No. It works like this. Your brain is sending signals to the larynx. Of course, there's no larynx there to catch the signals. That's true. And there's no larynx there to bob up and down. That's true. But the brain is sending larynx signals at the larynx, you know, and that's the thinking. The thinking is the larynx signals in your brain. Now, this is all nonsense. You don't think in words all the time. Anyhow, thought is much broader than language. It's all nonsense. But now, let's think of that picture. Here's the picture. The brain is sending larynx signals to the larynx, and the larynx isn't there. It just got, you know, cut out. So what do you have? You have the signal sent, but nothing there. That's the picture that I'm thinking of. The capacity of the brain to address the larynx even if there's no larynx there. Because it has, a part of the brain is formed to be, it's larynx stimuli. Another part is bicep stimuli. Another part is vision stimuli. And they're all programmed into the brain. Now, you don't have to be using them. They're there when you're asleep also. But the brain is programmed to be able to focus on all those things. That's the picture I have of the Rambam soul. That it has the capacity to be focused on all those things, even if there's nothing there to focus on. That's why I say it has a body face, or a body focus, even though there's no body there to catch it. That's
I don't understand. Are you saying that the soul, without going, are you saying that the soul in itself is... It seems to me that it's not passing through like the brain and then saying it's like it's doing directly. The soul is directly.
Because
you were saying that it was you know pointing to this one and pointing to that one.
Oh, okay, it points through the sections of the brain. The brain has a map. You know.
All right. Fine.
Point through the map. That's yeah.
The world of souls is something which is always going to be necessary. Even if Netzach Mashiach comes straight away to Kiyas HaMaisim, according to that. So then...
Why?
I'm saying just to get judged, or how is that going to work? That's what I'm asking. Is that always necessary, or could I go direct into Kiyas HaMaisim without going into, you know, where the dead people are now, let's say?
In the Messianic era, people aren't going to die. That's one view, anyway.
Where's the judgment take place to put them into that? I'm saying if Kiyas HaMaisim comes after...
After what?
After the Messianic era, meaning...
In other words, it's just one shot. Everybody is resurrected at the same moment.
Yeah, Netzach.
Okay.
It's not like that.
Then it's going on during the Messianic era. Those are the two choices.
People on earth.
Yeah.
That are already resurrected.
Yes.
And you can have some people still upstairs getting judged. I mean, how's this working?
Yeah, that's right. And you still have, at least the first stage, is people who are still alive from before the Messianic era. Yeah, you have all sorts of people. Listen, you know, you have to get used to living with different kinds of people, that's all.
There's no resurrection until Tiyas HaMaisim.
Yeah, that's where it's
going. Okay, and there's no Tiyas HaMaisim until the Mashiach?
Well, certainly not before the Mashiach. The only question is, will it be that the Messianic era is a long time? And resurrection will be a stage by stage process going throughout the whole period, or will it only be at the end in one shot that everybody will be up at the same time? Gee, I wanted to say something else.
Is this Messianic era? It's infinity.
No, Messianic era comes to an end. Messianic era is in this world. This whole world comes to an end.
After the Messianic era is the world to come?
That's right. The world to come required the transformation of the body into a memory of the soul. And the whole physical world has to be transformed into something else. I mean, to get out of this physical world that came as a result of the end of it in this condition. It ends up transformed. It doesn't get lost. It doesn't get cut off. It's not the Rambam's picture. Mm-hmm.
Of those who died and are in the holding pattern, whatever we do for Aliyah and Shema, that's all part of that process, whether it's 11 months following or it's 30 years later.
That's also true. What someone asked last week, which I don't have an answer to, is you're doing something for the Shema, but that in the meantime, that the Shema is reincarnated someplace else and it's down here functioning on its own. Does it still work? Yeah, that's right. It still works. But sure it works because... Your children can always benefit their parents, whether the parents are alive or parents are not alive, can always help.
Can the Shema be reincarnated in less than 11 months?
Yes, it can be, and because of Yibum. Because of Yibum, Yibum can take place in less than 11 months. Yibum is, well... Okay, when somebody dies without children, so the brother marries the widow, it can happen. I'll just tell you one last thing because I haven't got time to the other thing. I really wanted to get to it today because it's a brand new idea. I haven't spoken to my son about it, but it's a brand new idea. I'm very excited about it. I'll do it next week after my son says yes or no.
You bring him my brother.
Yeah, he's from Lakewood. Yeah, I bring him from Lakewood. Moses sees the Egyptian, and he says, "Beating a Jew," and he says, "It looks this way and that way." And he sees there's no man, and he kills him. Chazal say, He wasn't looking to make sure that he wouldn't be observed. He was looking to future generations to see whether any tzaddik, any righteous person, would be in this man's descendants. If there would be, he wouldn't kill him. He saw there was none, and therefore he killed him. So I want to know, what is Moses worried about? What is Moses trying to avoid? What would happen if this guy in his descendants is supposed to have a tzaddik, and Moses didn't look, and just killed him? What would happen? Well, of course, if you kill him, he's not going to have descendants. Good. What will happen to that tzaddik? That soul, which was scheduled to be in the descendants of this guy, and now he's dead. Is that soul not going to come into the world because the programmed progenitor died early? That's very, very hard to believe. That a human being would have the ability to determine which souls God brings into the world would be very hard to believe. Indeed, there's a statement in the Talmud that the Messiah will not come until all the souls in a certain receptacle come into the world. They all have to come into the world. So what? It means that that soul will come into the world in somebody else's line. Right? If so, who's the loser here? What is Moses trying to prevent? By looking and making sure that there's no tzaddik in his generations. The loser that's being protected here is the Egyptian man himself. He's being protected. Because as it is now, if that tzaddik is supposed to be in his descendants, he'll benefit from it. He'll benefit from the fact that one of his descendants is a tzaddik. If you kill him and the tzaddik is transferred to somebody else's line, this guy doesn't get the benefit. So this guy is a vicious criminal. Still, Moses wouldn't have killed him if it was programmed that he should get the benefit of having a righteous descendant. If I'm right, that's a tremendous chiddush. That's what Moses was worried about. Not to protect the tzaddik. The tzaddik will be a tzaddik anyhow. He'll be coming to somebody else's line. But the Mitzri, the Egyptian, won't have that benefit.
The other way.
No, that's not reason. How often first? No, I'm sure.